You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe, New Mexican, and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. Support for the Radio Cafe comes in part from the Lannan Foundation, presenting a reading and conversation by Nora Ericott with Janine Jackson on Wednesday, December 4th at 7 p.m. at the Lenzic Performing Arts Center. Nora Ericott is a human rights attorney whose book, Justice for Some, Law and the Question of Palestine, offers a new approach to understanding the Palestinian struggle for freedom told through the power and control of international law. Tickets available at the Lenzic or Lenzic.org or call 505-988-1234. I'd like now to welcome Michael Berman. He's a photographer and his new book is called Perdido, Sierra San Luis. There is a book signing and print signing with the artist on Saturday, November 23rd at 5 o'clock at 516 Arts, which is at 516 Central Avenue Southwest in Albuquerque. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. This is really deep and interesting work. It's a book of photographs and essays, including a lot about your own. There's essays by a couple of different people, several different people, but it's mostly your writing and photographs. And it's a lot about your explorations along the border of the U.S. and Mexico. The book is called Perdido, which means lost in Spanish. And you travel in a way that I think is really interesting, is really different from the way most people travel, you know, without a clear destination. In fact, you write that you don't believe in destinations. Talk about that process and the process, long process, that has resulted in this book.
One of the things in the book, and a lot of times it isn't clear, is there's really two parts to it. And one is the journey to find a place, and then the other is the place. And the place is really done with photographs, but the journey I ended up doing with stories, and it was a whole new world for me because I haven't written before. But I think the thing that comes to mind and is that I remember when I was a teenager, and you get a couple friends together and you scratch up a little bit of money for gas and you go somewhere. And that moment you're in the car, there's a real sense of like joy of like, we don't know where we're going, we don't know what we're going to do, but something will happen. And I think I found that in order to travel in the borderlands, and especially in Mexico, that one had to approach it with joy, and that often destinations were traps because there's this psychology of the border of needing to get into, in quotes, something, a place that's safe. And what I found is that often that meant you didn't go anywhere else. So for me, it was how do you create this thing of, I don't know where I'm going. So I had two metaphors. In the earliest part, I was with some friends who were trying to find trout that didn't exist. And I ended up thinking, well, maybe I'll look for old growth. And then eventually it became a more formalized project that I worked on with Charles Bowden, where I was looking at the Chihuahuan Desert and really the end of this great grassland. So in a sense, when you're looking for something that may not exist, then destinations are irrelevant.
Yeah, and this whole question of safety is really interesting to me because, okay, I'm going to be quoting from your essays a little bit, if you don't mind, because there's a lot of interesting stuff in there. One of the things you wrote was, I'm not scared of being lost. I'm most comfortable in a place where if I died, I would not be found. People scare me, and the border is infected with stories of imminent demise. It just made me think about, like, what makes me feel safe? Like, what makes a place feel safe? What makes other people feel safe or frightened? And you know, the places that you're going, there's not a lot of people. There are places where most people wouldn't necessarily survive very well if they didn't have a backpack full of food and stuff and water and so on. And yet, the really scary part is the human part, whether it's like unfriendly people or drug traffickers or people with guns, border patrol agents. Talk about that.
Well, one of the things is that my earlier work was actually in a landscape that was devoid of people, but most of this book deals with the Sierra Madres and Chihuahua, which is a landscape that has people in it. There's really none of it that's really abandoned or so harsh that there aren't people. But it's as simple as this. You have to make friends. And I think that's really the thing of throwing yourself into a place and becoming comfortable with what's there. And often when I'd return, sometimes people would say something similar to what you said. And the reaction on a, you know, especially if I was still close to a trip, would be like, you know, I go to northern Mexico. I have a truck that has 400,000 miles on it. It breaks down. And when I break down there, the first person who comes along will help me. And if they can't fix it, they'll invite me to their house and feed me and eventually find a friend or family member, somebody who can fix the truck. And so I'm a real human being. Whereas if I break down on this side of the border, people won't even look at you. You know, it's like you're expected to call on a cell phone. You don't exist. So what's going on there is really much more human relationships. So you can label people. And you know, I do a little bit of that. And there are some real dangers. But in the end, there is a moment of human interaction where you have to become a person. And often I find sometimes it's as simple as asking for help. Other times it's as simple as the question of who you are. And then at that moment, in some ways for me, it's easy. It's like, and you can see I'm doing it now, which your radio people can't see, but I get this smile on my face of like, who am I? I'm a photographer. And then it's like, I want to be here. I don't know why. I'm looking for something. And I think people would sense that. And then, you know, I also learned some tricks, you know, that sometimes I found that you'd be in an uncomfortable situation. And it's really the thing of how you gracefully separate yourself. So sometimes you'd run into a bunch of men who were drinking and they'd want you to drink with them. So, you know, courtesy says you have one drink. Well, it's 9 o'clock in the morning and these guys have been at it for a few days. So I'll have one drink. And then, and it came naturally because the one time it happened and I really wanted to climb this mountain that was, you know, where they lived. And so I was like, you know, you guys come with me. I'm going to go for a long walk up that mountain. They're like, no, you come with me. We want a drink. And, you know, after a few minutes, we part company of like, yeah, see you later. You know, I'll come back. But I think it's really the thing of becoming a human being, which you do through conversation and being vulnerable. And I think we've forgotten that. I mean, and I know when I wrote this, there's probably one or two things that get to dangerous moments. But in the end, I left out most of the things that were like that. I think partially because, again, I work with Charles Bowden, who did that really well. And then partially is that I don't like that narrative of the border because, you know, nothing bad ever happened to me. And even when I was in situations that things were happening, is that in the end, if I can refer again to that being a 16, 17-year-old in the car with your friends, is that when you came back, you had a story. And so for a while, you felt like you were energized and alive. And you were, because you really had things to contend with. Stuff was happening. And, you know, then you come back into our world here and the sort of excitement and you know, what it is to be alive becomes more like everything's easy here, except it becomes sort of dull and gray and like, yeah, I can go and get it all at Walmart. My car breaks down, I just get on the cell phone or I have AAA. I mean, it's all these other things which we think are conveniences, but they're not. You know, we only get to live one time and it loses that sort of a thing of navigating what it is to be alive.
One of the stories that was striking was you get to a place and there's a lot of gates and locked gates in your travels and in the stories that you tell. And at one of them, there's a kind of scary looking guy in a pickup truck that says, I don't like Americans. And you start talking and your MO is to just like keep talking. And he's like, oh, I know who you are. You went fishing with your friends. You gave a ride to my uncle. You're cool.
Yeah, no, and that was really in a place that, you know, I know other writers who've gone there and had problems. And that does happen. You know, there are people who, you know, they just don't like gringos. And so it really was a sense of like, it just felt like everybody has a bad trip to Mexico and this was going to be mine. But it really, the arc of things were that in a moment or two, he sort of, oh yeah, no. Because my early trips, I really went with two friends who really just, they wanted to find trout and they wanted to find a new species. And we were going to mountains that didn't even have water in it. And so that story gets around. And then, you know, one of my friends, Mike Goss, he's a really beautiful grace with old people. So we often stayed with these old people who weren't leaving the mountains, and their family was watching them. So I think we had a little reputation for sort of like, yeah, they're these crazy gringos. And yeah, they stayed with my uncle, or, you know, they helped somebody or this or that. And so, you know, again, it's becoming a person. So it was that moment, you know, the one time where I felt like, oh, I'm not going to be able to talk my way around this one. And then all of a sudden it just flipped. Whereas a lot of other times you get gentle guidance in Mexico when you're in these areas, so you have to pay attention. But a lot of times people will say something like, there's a ghost jaguar in that canyon, so you can't go in there. Or, you know, some crazy story. And
are those like codes?
Yeah, it's a straight up code. It's if you're told, if somebody is being friendly to you and they tell you not to go somewhere, you don't go there. And if you want to go there, you indicate it's important and maybe you have to come back a couple times, you know,
right,
till it opens up. Because all of it, again, this, the mountains and Chihuahua and the desert, it's not like the U.S. where there's sort of public land, you can do what you want, which is a big change for me, because in the U.S. I like the idea you get to disappear and I get to do what I want. Whereas in Mexico, you have to announce yourself. So there's a little bit of difference. As, you know, sometimes you look for a human being or a house, and even though you wouldn't need to do it, you go there and learn to tell your story. And I think one of the things is, you know, the book Over the Arc of the Story is that I didn't know how to speak Spanish when I started. You know, my friends did, but once I sort of was like, I'm really tired of fishing and I want to go off, their gift to me was really, I was sort of scared of Mexico and who would want to go there. And a couple friends got me to go there. And then, you know, I started traveling a few trips with them. And then it just clicked to being like, I want to go here. You know, this is amazing. In a sense of our landscapes now that have so many people, and also the whole thing of the problem of tourism, is that one thing, it's wonderful, we travel, we see other places, but then we overwhelm them. You're going to a place where it's always good to be first in. So a lot of these places is a genuine tourist who is just traveling through, was really like such an oddity that people didn't know what to do with me, kind of thing. So
you were setting out to find old growth forest, which turned out to be pretty tricky because a lot of the old growth forest had been cut down and destroyed in one way or another. Talk about, like, what did you think was there? Why did you think it? What did you actually find?
You know, it's kind of, you know, the ignorance born in a kind of vision for other places is like a heart of darkness of, oh, I don't know this place, so therefore it must be something incredible and wild. So the Sierra Madres, you know, you look on a map and it's this huge area. And so, you know, you have a sense of like, well, you know, there's got to be something up there. The other thing is ecologically, the sort of ignorance of Mexico is that this is the territory of the Apaches. And if you grow up in America, you watch Apaches movies where they always go to Canyon de Chelly and they go to Navajo and the Pueblo lands. Well, the Sierra Madres are really a sister to the Mogollon Mountains, to the Gila River and that kind of territory. So really what I found is when I crossed the border and got into the Sierra Madres, there were subtle differences in ecology as you shifted, but it really was this great pine forest, yellow pine forest. It's shifting to a Chihuahuan pine, but, you know, for most people, it looks like a ponderosa pine. So it's this thing of there was a great forest, but in the end, they're gone. And it's even a sense of connecting things like, you know, the monarch butterflies, is that if you look at the pictures of where they're wintering, which is way further south in Mexico, again, it's a sort of yellow pine. But then when you really get more intimate with traveling is the places and spaces where those trees are, it's the same sort of pressure everywhere, is that if people can get a road to it, they do. And there can be many reasons, as simple as I need to feed my family, or as complex as an international bank will lend somebody money for a road who then, you know, goes and puts a road in and get, you know, harvests these trees on a industrial level. And when they go away, there's a huge amount of debt, so that the folks who had the trees didn't make money, but somebody did. So it's this sense of the illusion of an unending world. And I think a lot of it for me is confronting my ignorance. And I also have a thing in the long conversations I had with Charles Bowden, is they'd often end up with, how do you see what's there? And it was really both of our sort of quixotic thing of really in his writing, he was trying to write about the border that was there, and often people would confuse it fiction, nonfiction, what is this, real, not real? And it's the same thing of the ability to see what's there. I find it's very rare in our culture because it's not necessary.
Well, you know, they say you see what you believe, you see what you already know on some level.
Yeah.
And what was one of the things that was interesting to me about your work and your book and how you see is you bring a number of perspectives that don't always come in the same human being. You're a photographer, you're an artist, you're a writer, you're a hunter. You call yourself a radical environmentalist, and much more than that too. Those are all different ways of seeing. And I found myself wondering, are those separate perspectives for you? Have they all sort of become integrated?
I may say, you know, and again, it's what's coming to my mind, is that I was someone who, you know, my parents died when I was very young, like 3 years old. It really wasn't a traumatic thing for me, so I don't remember it that way. But what that means is I never really had an authority to tell me what to do. And when you describe each of these things, is there used to be traditions of you learn from an elder how to see the world. And I would argue in our cultures, we've lost our connection to elders who have something they can teach us. And so in many ways, my quandary in life is kind of like, I keep, you know, you're labeling these different things, but it maybe again come back to that simple thing of this thing of trying to see what's there or trying to find something complex enough to fully engage me. You know, life is the drug, the ultimate drug. And so it's the thing when it opens up, it should be and can be amazing. And so it's not always like that. But again, when you write a book, you don't write about like, yeah, I sat around for a year and did nothing and was, you know, worked in my dark room or something like that. It tends to be, you know, a sense of these were moments in which something was happening.
Well, your process was fascinating to me too. I mean, you walk around a lot without your camera, and I was like, is this a typo? You sometimes walk around for years and years in the same place without your camera, to the point where that place changes before you've even photographed it sometimes.
I think, you know, and you're asking me what I am, you know, like the culture labels me as a photographer, and, you know, sometimes when I give talks, it's sort of my laugh line, but, you know, if I go off in the desert 40 days and 40 nights and say I'm a photographer, it's all good. But if I don't have something I'm doing, people think you're crazy. So the photo thing provides me with legitimacy. It also was something that I was able to do well, both technically and in terms of personality. It's like some things are easy for me to do. And I'm thinking about the writing I did in this book, which turned out to be like I'm dyslexic. I've actually flunked years in school when they decide to look at structure or spelling. So it's like, why am I writing? I hate this. You know, there's no fluidity. It's a tremendous amount of work. So I don't know. You choose different things that you do. So
I sometimes do this little exercise where I'll go outside and I'll look around me and I'll think, I'm a geologist, or I'm a botanist, or I'm an artist, or I'm a criminal escaping, you know, and each of those things like makes me look at the landscape in a different way.
It's interesting because until you got to the criminal escaping, is that what you were somewhat talking about are labelers, is that most of our scientific approach to seeing a landscape starts with naming and labeling and goes on from there until you get to the criminal escaping. And then that's like, you know, all of a sudden it's someone who has to deal with the world and has a problem, and it's different things. But I, again, you know, this is an interesting time to be alive in that we have so much wealth, and really we share in this abundance, but yet the consequence of that means that we're using things up but it's really anyone of my generation, and I'm getting old. I got to talk to young people today, and I'm curious about them, but we have no excuses that even the poorest, well, let's not say the poorest, but let's say so many of us have enough wealth to have made choices to do many things. And, you know, a lot of what we did is, you know, cars, houses, careers, build roads. And in a sense, that's what we spent our treasure on. And I think it is, again, coming back to the gifts we are given and the ones we choose. And I'm perplexed. I think this, the conceptual idea of this planet and the planet we live on, it's really an amazing thing. And so many people seem to orient themselves to either changing it or, you know, what they do when they get off it, you know, like the post-life thing. And so I think there is something to finding something that will fully engage you and that's complex and difficult, and that I think people are most happy when they do that. And sometimes I think they don't even recognize it. A lot of times, you know, somebody's in the most difficult, say a teacher in the most difficult school, and they find a life in that, and they come to do amazing things. You know, they come to learn a way of engaging. So what we label ourselves, I don't know. I guess the nice thing is that if you're an artist in this culture, you're not anything. You know, you can
what
be.
What do you mean?
Well, that you know, what is an artist? I throughout my life is, you know, who are you, an artist? And the second question I always get is, do you make any money? So it's not even, you know, saying you're an artist.
Only in the U.S.
Right. Well, this is my world.
Yeah.
I did leave the last 3 years. I did spend the summer in Mongolia, and that was just on a sort of like, well, I'll go to the most remote place I can find and to test and affirm some of my beliefs. But, you know, in some ways, I think as foible as this country or nation is, it still is a grand experiment of whether human beings can get beyond a singular story. And I think that's sort of what we're confronting right now, is that everyone wants their story to be the one that's true, correct, most important, and they fail to recognize how similar the story they're telling is. And really, I think the great story of this country is that it's not set in stone here, is that it's still, we're still in contention for what is most important, and we're still able to be both, have our grand ignorance shown to us. And I think, you know, obviously I'm in the category of white male, and we're in sort of the time in which people are saying, dude, you don't know everything, and your vision is really a single, just one of many. And at the same time, we are learning the breadth of possibility for relationships and what people can do. And at the same time, it's a mess. You know, it's not like this is all easy and working out well right now. And, you know, for the thing I care about the most, which is a landscape in which human beings protect it but don't use it, you know, that is not seen as singularly important. And
don't use it?
Don't use it. There was a philosopher, I think Ralston Holmes or Holmes Ralston, in the 60s, he wrote an essay that basically put forward the idea that nature can have value in and of itself beyond human beings. He could not get it published. And he managed to get it published in Europe a few years later. And then in the 70s, he got the Templeton Prize, which is the one better than the Nobel Prizes. And really that idea that there's value in nature beyond humans is something that was so assumed that it wasn't even considered until very recent history. And it may be, you know, again, this challenging of vision is that there may be part of what we're going through is acknowledging other cultures that have had more of a connection and seeing themselves as part of this world. But
well, seeing yourself as part of a world doesn't mean you don't use it. It just means you don't have an extractive mentality toward it. You have maybe a reciprocal mentality toward it, right? Or not?
I would say, you know, if I would agree with creating that sort of language, but I think one of the more important epiphanies for me was that, you know, when I moved to the Gila, there was a great deal of contention over grazing. And I was trying to learn all this stuff. And one of the ranchers at the center of the Diamond Bar Laney, we had a conversation, and he's a very good cowboy. I had worked a ranch, and this guy could cowboy. He's a really bad ecologist. You know, he's the kind of cowboy who'd go like, well, can't we just cut all the cottonwoods down to get my cows through this one season? But I sat with him at his table, and I went through this long conversation about the history of his ranch and what he wanted to do, which was put more water out and increase numbers, and how if he looked at the numbers over time in 100 years, if he got what he wanted, he would probably not be able to run any cows. And he looked at me and he said, that's okay. If my family didn't use this land, it never would have been worth anything. And part of me could have been sort of like, oh, that's a kind of revolting thing. But what it was for me was an epiphany of, oh, I'm not seeing value. What he's saying to me is that what makes this land valuable is it feeds my family, it creates my community. And if the land doesn't do that, what is it worth? And, you know, in my sort of myopic viewpoint is that, like, land doesn't need human beings. We've only been on the planet for, you know, some measure 30,000 years, some 150, some 3 million. You know, you start to get to 6 million years and, you know, nobody's saying there are humans around.
Yeah, primates. But
yeah, exactly. So again, it's hard for us to see beyond this world being for us.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, you talk about wilderness, and the very idea of wilderness was given to us by Aldo Leopold. And it's sort of like you have to destroy a lot of wilderness before it even becomes a concept in a way. It's sort of like you don't know water until you get out of the water kind of thing. But one of the things that you wrote was, wilderness is not a word, nor is it manifest in a photograph. It is more, it is this world without us. It is one of the things we fear most, an affirmation of our insignificance. And as I was reading that, I was thinking, first of all, of that wonderful book called The World Without Us, which is by Alan Weisman, who talked about what would actually happen on this beautiful, crazy earth if we were to all just sort of vanish in a moment. And it's a great book. But it also made me think about that thing, which is sort of the most difficult thing to do, which is to imagine your own death.
Or even more so, our own insignificance.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, a lot of times things are like dreams, or I work so hard on something, when I finish it, I like, you know, people are quoting it to me and I'm like, I wrote that? What's that about? But when I was done with it, I was like, oh, I missed the whole thing. And I really came to a sense of, you know, and I may have said this or ended with this, is like, wilderness is an experiment we have not yet done. And it really, to me at the time, was really the idea of protecting a landscape. But when I started was thinking about this stuff and processing where I was, my mind's always changing on things. And this summer I drove the whole Rio Grande for the show on endangered species, and I had this little sort of like, oh, I may not be getting this yet, but I was realizing is that we being me, to see things in a static way. So when we're looking at something like endangered species, we sort of say, well, if we can preserve this one little place, then we'll preserve this species. And that's all wrong. Is that preserving one little place won't matter to a species. And the other thing is, a species is not a static thing. And they change over time. And what I was realizing is that the landscapes that are important and that would be important are really of a scale in which species could evolve. You know, in Mongolia, I went to the most remote place, and it still has like 300 of these Gobi bears, which are a subspecies of grizzly bears, and it still has the snow leopards and wolves and the last of the camels. It's not an environment in which any of these species, maybe the camel might, no, the camel couldn't, because it's a species that's adapting to hot desert rather than starting there. So none of these species could evolve there. So to really say like, oh, we'll preserve these species because we have this one little piece of land or this thing designated as wilderness, none of it's going to work, because what we call wilderness is really where we couldn't get roads to. So in one way, I have this real problem with the idea of wildernesses are something to do with roads. They really should have something to do with ecological integrity. And it may be what humans do in generations to come, is really figure out how to accommodate themselves as a species and also these other living things in a more dynamic world, rather than, you know, at this point in time, we have a you know, at best a zoo mentality towards conservation, or like it's all good if we create connectivity, but it really is missing what we came from and where we'll go. I mean, you know, a lot of deep thinkers now are really pointing out that humans are evolving. We're evolving to our technology. And so we are changing as species. But the unfortunate thing is that we're taking a lot of the other species with us. And I think that's not necessary.
A piece of that, which I found really fascinating, and I love maps, and I like to look at maps and different kinds of maps, and the map of the West, and then the John Wesley Powell map of the West that mapped watersheds instead of state boundaries and things like that. And your take on maps was, I mean, first of all, you must use them because you'd be totally lost if you didn't, to some extent. I mean, you have some vague sense of where you're going and where mountains are and so on. But at the same time, there are real limitations with maps. Talk about that.
I think, you know, maps are this incredible gift, and they have this incredible power. I mean, there's this whole story of the English conquered India, not with on the ground, but by mapping it. And maps imbue power. And there's another analysis of the U.S. is that through mapping, we could sell the land. And that's really the story of colonization. It's not the people on the ground, it's the surveyors. So maps are incredibly powerful, and I rarely look at Google Earth. I don't like it because it's too easy. But often what maps give to you is a way of finding a possible place. I mean, it's an amazing thing. You lay them out and look at things. But I would say this, is that there's a real transition of once you begin to know a landscape well, you don't use maps anymore. And I think I also was, you know, contemplating the idea of what it means to be indigenous. And I would say that would sort of fit with where I was moving towards, is that people are really of a place. They know it. They don't need maps. I mean, in a sense, maps are intimate. It's like, you know, you may give a map a name or a GPS coordinate or a longitude and latitude, but to them it's like, no, that's where I hunted the deer, or that's where my father died, or that's where we grow corn, or that it's a much different relationship. And I found, you know, one of the things that's part of the book is about learning to hunt, something I thought I'd never do. And I just got out last week from the annual hunt that I do, and it really is a sense, you know, I've gone 10, 15 years, and this trip was, I'm beginning not to use maps, and I ran into this kid who's 30 years old and grew up in the same, his ranch was right next to where I hunt, and it was a sort of exchange. You always give some information and other information. He was saying, oh, I want to do what you guys are doing, because we're dry camping up on this mountain that's not supposed to have water. And I just looked at him and said, there is water up there, but not for your horse. But I never told him where it was, because it's the sense of, it's easy to find it. But in a sense, you have to have both time and willingness to go into a place where you don't know it. So maps are strange, but I think you don't know a landscape until you actually don't need a map of it. As long as you're using a map, you're bringing power from the outside. You know, maps are a way of taking things, including knowledge. So yeah, they're great. I can cheat the world with it. You know, even going to Mongolia, you know, the final trip when I knew I wanted to get into these remote things, you know, for $60 I bought Russian tapos of the entire country. And all of a sudden things open up with those tapos. There's water on it, there's roads on it that you can't see on Google Earth, and you know, this is the space I want to go to, kind of thing. So
That's cheating?
Well, yeah, I think it is cheating. I mean, I think in a sense, you are not required, you know, where we started with this thing of saying, you know, oh, is it dangerous, or how do you get in these landscapes? Is one way is to make friends. The other way is to, you know, buy a map, buy a guide, pay for vehicles and all these other things. And I think that model is, I'm not sure how relevant that is. I think it rings of a sort of arrogance of, if I have the power, I can come here and take everything I want. It's easy. And also I think it's just too easy, that there is something. I know a couple of times old friends of mine I've taken hunting with me, and one of my closest friends from high school, who's the big Jack Strong guy, he got to Silver at dark and it was snowing, and we went and had dinner, and after it stopped snowing, I was like, hey, you know, it's going to be a full moon. Let's go to the trailhead because we better be there in the morning. So we get to the trailhead about 10, 11 at night. And I'm like, you know, it's a full moon. Let's just walk up. And so it's a 6-mile walk in. And so, you know, he tells the story, he nearly died. But he tells the story. And, you know, he's someone I've taken deer hunting. And, you know, he one time saw a deer and it was such a shock to see it sitting in front of him just right there that he forgot he was hunting and it got up and walked away. But it is a sense of he earned that landscape in a way that would have been real different than years later he found out, like, oh, we can get horses. And I'm like, yeah, horses are expensive. And he's like, Michael, I got a real job. You know, how much is it? And I told him what it was. He's like, we're getting horses, which will never be the same. You know, that having walked 6 miles at night and really been exhausted beyond belief to someone who's like, when I do on vacations, I do whatever I want and I pay for it. That it's like, no, you actually have to walk there. And he did. He brought his son the year after that. And, you know, our idea was he would be our mule. You know, like his son was in great shape and strong. It's like, well, we'll get him to come and bring stuff up. So I think there is something for extending beyond what you can do. And sometimes, you know, GPSs and all this information, you know, we're finding out somebody in the woods with a GPS and it breaks, or they go places they're not really prepared for because, you know, I got a GPS, or now I think, I'm not even sure of it, but, you know, you have technology where you can contact a satellite. And so a lot of people I know are starting to use that. And I think that separates you from the experience you're seeking. You know, which is really a relationship that depends on your knowledge. And knowledge is, again, maps are knowledge that's given, but it's a different knowledge than you actually going there and learning a place. So,
another thing that I think is really important to talk about is the difference between catastrophic events and chronic conditions where it comes to ecosystems and natural places. What is that distinction?
You know, that might have been where I started. I said I've ended with this idea of evolution. But one of the things I've noticed is that, you know, we use this word catastrophic, and it sounds like, oh, catastrophic, it's done. It turns out if you look at natural systems, is that catastrophic events had been the way in which almost all these systems renewed themselves, and they were built in. So the idea of fires or floods, you know, these big events, is that actually what they did is they reset ecosystems in complex ways that they responded to, and that they were ready for it, that they moved through it. There are many species that wouldn't even occur until you had one of these events. And so that in a sense, it's like you overlay this thing of them being a bad thing. And then I was looking at our landscapes and really the way we approach management and the way we approach relationships. And often it's really this idea that you can do the same thing again and again, year after year, in the same way. And what's really obvious is that in a catastrophic event is that the system is responding to what's going on. Whereas in chronic things, it's often really an overlay of humans are saying, well, let's just do this. And that what I was noticing is that really over time is that these small chronic things ended up diminishing the landscape, shifting them. And then, you know, my trips to Mongolia is you're really watching the dissolution of the grasslands that happened here in the 1800s is happening now, is that they for a long time had a really, and the other thing that went with that was consequential relationships, is for a long time is if you, you know, Mongolia is one of the great pastoral cultures. And for a long time, if they overgrazed, they died. You know, that was as simple as that, is that you had to be in balance. And that, you know, now they're in our world. So, you know, they're running Kashmir for a market. They have jeeps. You know, it's a transition to the modern world. And that economic system means that their lands, they, you know, you're watching the soils disappear. You know, something I see, and it was just a little epiphany, is that little bit all the time is something that an ecological system isn't set up for. It's really set up for a dynamic, continual sort of change, but a response in which everything is responding to everything else, rather than somebody saying, oh no, we'll just put 10 of these, or we'll just put a fence up, or we'll just try and do the same thing year after year.
Well, like some examples of that are, there are landscapes I mean, we're sitting in the middle of one right now, which is adapted to fire. We need wildfires to have healthy forests. And then in the absence of those, you've got huge problems and all the ways they're trying to solve them. But then there are, because of fire suppression, there are truly catastrophic fires that don't help the landscape. I mean, there's soil that's completely destroyed, you know, a foot or two down, and those landscapes aren't coming back. And then there are really weird things, like you have in your book the example of, you know, Chernobyl, which was an unmitigated disaster, except it freed the place of people, and then those landscapes came back. And there was a book that compared two islands in the South Pacific, one of which had a nuclear bomb test and the other of which had hotels. They were about the same size and they were about in the same place, and you can see where this is going. The marine ecology around the hotel island was in much worse shape than the one that had had the nuclear test.
And that I think is, it again, it just comes to there's so few spaces that have a reprieve from human use. And human use is so, what's the number, 7 billion and going on 12? Is that it really is ubiquitous and everywhere. And also there's an inequity in resources, in that, you know, some people are really literally trying to feed themselves and other people are, you know, they have multiple houses, they're flying around the world, da 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 da. So it's this thing of we're using everything in multiple ways, and the spaces that don't get, to even see a space that does not get human use is really difficult. I mean, one of the two things of the book, and I don't know, you know, again, I'm not quite, you know, writing for me was like, I did the best I could. I spent a year and a half doing this, and it was a sense of I left a lot out. But, you know, one of the little tricks of the Sierra Madres is if you want to find good ecological spaces, they're probably where narcos are growing stuff. You won't be able to get into those unless you're willing to engage in a sort of iffy behavior. And I find most science folks are, you know, their personalities are a little more towards get the grant, be safe, go to a place that's easy to go to every year. So they don't go in those places. Same thing with enviros. So it's a sense of finding a place, you know, it ends up being these crazy extremes of, you know, the DMZ, or I hadn't heard about the one you said, but, you know, these, the Barry on Goldwater bombing range, which, you know, I photographed there and worked on, you know, it's been incredible there. I'm not sure what this new sort of crazy unmitigated sort of get to do what you want on the border, if your border patrol probably has really impacted that. But again, it's part of this complexity. And I think,
but like a bombing range having more biodiversity than a park or something.
Not only that, is that there were places in terms of current bombing, the hotter it gets, the better ecology you get. And the reason for that, at least this is information about 15 years old, because, you know, they've gotten to close those places off a lot tighter. There were reasons the public could go on them, which you had to be savvy. Actually, in the law, there was a paragraph that said they had to allow the public on. I found that. I was like, hey, you got to let me on. And they didn't really, but they did. What I saw is that in the hot zones, it was really good because the bombing is so accurate now that it's really one small area. But around the hot zone, they don't let anybody in because, you know, that's the nature of it, is they don't want an accident to happen. But the other thing is you'd find...
And so there's wildlife and...
Oh, yeah. And the plants and soil is the big thing. But the other thing I found is that if you get in the areas that were heavily bombed, say, during World War II, when they were really practicing and lots of sort of iron munitions were going down, you can be in places where there's just fragments and, you know, fodder is what they call it, but, you know, pieces of bombs everywhere. And ecologically, it's, you know, it's in better shape than much of our wilderness. And that's a crazy thing. But it really is. It's a catastrophic thing. A bomb hits and then it reorganizes. And it has next to it soil and other stuff. And a lot of what you're talking about in these fires we're having now is that we, through our sort of chronic use of forestry and grazing and unmitigated recreation, we've created this condition where we've debilitated a lot of these landscapes so they're not so resilient. And then, you know, everyone who was in the conversation knew these big fires were coming. And what you could see is because of the way money's budgeted and the way people act is that they put out the small fires that they could, and then the big ones would burn. So over time, you weren't getting the multiple fires that would have worked, but eventually you're getting bigger and bigger fires. And then obviously the conditions of the change of the climate, but also, you know, what we set up over 100, 200 years of management led to these big burns. But I will say this, is I am someone who think that walking in a forest that's been burned is amazing, and it is incredibly beautiful. And especially if you can find a forest that, again, where the system is being allowed to reorganize. The Sierra San Luis, where I went to, has a couple things going on. One is that it did get the same fires, so most of the forest burned. But it also has Cuenca de los Ojos, a ranch there, or a series of about 9 ranches that an American woman has bought, Valerie Clark. And she's tried everything. She's very big on doing gabions and to rehabilitate this landscape. And so she's given us this gift of seeing what can happen. It was she spent a fortune doing it, but it really is a sense of what's possible for these landscapes. So in the Sierra San Luis, you have many different kinds of ranching, from old traditional ranchers to this woman from the U.S., as well as, you know, certain parts have been abandoned by people. They're just too hard to get into, and those are my favorite places. And then other parts are like, and I was showing photographs today to students, and all of a sudden I'm like, do you know what those cups mean? It's just a bunch of plastic cups. And, you know, anyone who, you know, probably in Northern California, you'd know that now, but, you know, that's how they start marijuana plants, is in little plastic cups. So you start finding a couple hundred of those on the ground, and you sort of, you should know where you are, but the black pipe or different things. But so it's a complex mountain range that, you know, right now it's in the news because it's in contention for who will control this area. So the murders in La Mora and things like that all tie into this area. But it does show in these areas that have burned, they're still rather amazing to be in if they're really, humans already aren't back in. And, you know, one of the big things with fire right now is there's a huge amount of money in fighting the fires, but also in doing the rehab. I've yet to see in one of these more complex areas where the ecosystem was intact, where the rehab didn't introduce huge problems, you know, either seeds or suppressing the sequence of either the soils, getting their biotic communities, or really the plants that come afterwards are suppressed, and then you have this sort of strange mess going on. But I encourage people to not do a knee-jerk thing of, oh, this, the forest is gone, because it may be gone for your lifetime, but the forest is not gone. 100 years, 1,000 years, it's still a choice. You know, what will be there, we don't know. And, you know, question is whether we'll be here. That may be the bigger one.
I can't remember exactly the words you used, but sort of what I got from it was the sense of the futility of land management and how, and you're sort of talking about that, like when you try to manage landscapes, it's almost like a hubris. But what's the alternative?
I would say, you know, one of the interesting things about Mexico is, again, Americans have a very sort of myopic view of the world, but the ranches were started way before our ranches. So I have a friend whose ranch in northern Mexico began in the late 1600s. And so they've been ranching a long time. And some of these ranches are actually in incredibly good condition. So one of the things I was doing was looking for aplomato falcons, again, in when I was looking at grasslands. And you know, one of these ranches, the guy who ran it basically, you know, looked at me one day and said, you know, I don't do anything fancy, but what I do is I stock for dry years. I use really large pastures. And then the other thing is he breeds cows for his ranch. So a lot of, especially in the national forest, you can buy a cow from Florida, a cow from the Midwest, a cow from anywhere. There's yearling operations. And these animals are thrown into these environments, and it really is, you know, it's a relationship we're all involved in. I want to be careful to say that I don't excuse ranchers, but I also don't blame them. I think we're in a partnership with them. Most of this management is everybody's involved in it. But there really are these ranches in Mexico that over hundreds of years are still in really good shape. And part of it is that when they break that relationship, then they lose their grass. So, you know, a large amount of ranch land in Mexico has lost that relationship, much like our ranch land. So that there really is this thing of what is that number that can work on the land, and then
How do you move your cattle and so on?
Yeah, and also understanding that that use of the land will change it. And so, you know, my thing I'm advocating for is that we really need to have both. I know there's, you know, some of the old ranches I know, you know, they know their ranches are not really great for cattle. And so they want a transition, but essentially they have huge amount of money locked up in permits. But the way the game is played is they can't sell them, and you can't retire a permit. So I've had friends who bought ranches and tried to remove cattle, but after 10 years, it becomes a sort of game and a problem. So it really is something, a conversation most people are kind of really unwilling to have in terms of saying, we need to really evaluate these landscapes. The Gila was really close to it. If you look at the maps for grazing in about 2003, you'll see that because there was a great deal of contention and really forcing people to look at what's happening on the ground, is about half the allotments were being grazed and half the allotments weren't being grazed. And if you knew what was going on those allotments, and I actually, as a crazy thing, went and looked at each of them and sort of applied my old biological skills of doing habitat analysis, is that, you know, many of the ones being grazed were really the ones where you could do it, and you could do it as a family operation. And many of the ones that weren't being grazed were really ones where it's pretty simple. Many of the allotments don't even have fences on them, and especially as you get towards the wilderness. And then right now people are trying to sort of avoid the conversation of why there's a herd of feral cattle in the Gila River in the middle of the wilderness. It's everyone's trying to ignore it and pretend like it doesn't exist. But it's really pretty simple if you don't have fences and it's rough country. You don't get all your cows out. And so, is this the rancher's fault or is it all our fault? I think it's all our fault. I think it's my fault because for a while I attended to this issue and then it gets to be a lot of work and unpleasant. And so I'd rather go to northern Mexico on the border and play there. You know, it's a lot safer and more fun.
We've been talking for quite a while, so I want to just wrap up with two things. First of all, let's talk about the photographs themselves. They're not the kind of grand, majestic Ansel Adams kind of landscapes. They seem to me to tell a lot of stories about a very specific bit of earth or grassland or water or some objects that have been left behind that somebody left behind, and they have a meaning. And you don't put captions, and I can understand, I can guess why you don't, because you don't want people's imagination to be limited by the story that you tell in the caption. But at the same time, I'm like, I'm dying to know, like, what is this? But, you know, it just brought up a lot of questions, like, of how you choose what to photograph, and are they stories for you, each one?
I think, you know, I'm beginning to sort of, like, there's something strange about this book. One is, you know, the book is really beautiful, and the folks at the Museum of New Mexico Press, I think everything came together. So there is a quality where they're seductive to look at. And really what you're talking about is we're often used to the idea of like this grand shot of something that's an anomaly in the landscape, whether it's a cloud or a geological formation. And that I've sort of always been doing something different, and it's back to that conversation with Charles Bowden of the landscape that's there. But I also think it's a sense of, you know, what I was just saying to people of the idea of like go into these fires without a preconceived idea, but it's really seeing the subtlety and beauty of these landscapes that we're really walking over and walking by. And there are things in it is that at the heart of this book is this place that Valera Clark has sort of removed the cows from and let recover, is she has ciénagas that have recovered. And rather than being arroyos, they're now like higher than the land around them and full of life and reeds. So it is this sense of, I guess it's what I've been working at my whole life, is how do you see these small things and see that they're important? And it's a really sort of amusing career choice because it confuses most people. I think people often recognize the significance of what I'm doing, but then, you know, often I'm in the art world and in a gallery And they're confused by, like, well, why would I want one of these on their wall? But I do know this. I had someone I know walked up to me the other day and said, I have one of your photographs on the wall, and every morning when I wake up, I look at it, and it makes me smile. And I was thinking, huh, I wonder which one it is. But it really was one of these little photographs. And I think, you know, that the arc of the book is one born in despair, but it's also one also that the only cure for despair is joy. And so in a sense, you know, that's putting myself out there in this world, is saying I'm seeing what I care most about being destroyed. And I'm also, you know, I don't give quarter to anyone. I think the environmental community is most remiss right now in prioritizing a conversation of maps or category, new wilderness or things like that, when we're really down to the end of, you know, how what we protect.
What do you think they should be doing?
Well, I think it's a simple thing. I think we just had a dose of Greta coming through, and she was just clear things. It's not that difficult. It's really speaking truth to power, but actually protecting the land on the ground. I was fortunate to have Tim DeChristopher do the introduction, and he's become quiet because he's really trying to figure out how to deal with this conversation. And he gave a really beautiful lecture in Silver City. And he had this line, let's see if I can get it, is democracy wasn't built for fascism. But the other thing he was really saying is that we've, in the environmental community, have really been working on 5 and 10 and 15 year plans on, like, well, we want something, so we'll build a coalition, and then we'll, you know, we'll do the brochures and we'll do the movement, and then we'll get this thing. And he was really pointing out is that no, the things are changing and moving so fast that we have to really be in the moment. And I think politically that's rather obvious, is that the folks we're contending with, you know, they're not playing by any rules. They're saying, you know, all right, you win that, we'll just change the rules. So I think it's a sense of really prioritizing what's important. And for me, it's the land. But I think many people have things that are important. For other people, it's folks coming across the border. And for other people, it's really figuring out their place in this world. And so I just think it's a sense of really, you know, not looking towards what will make you comfortable, but really what you think is most important. And really, you know, less stuff and more living and life, you know, more doing of things. You know, I know so much of my life I've locked up time and resources in, you know, a new camera or something silly like that, when it didn't make a difference.
Michael Berman's new book is called Perdido, Sierra San Luis. He will be at the 516 Arts Space. It's a wonderful art space in Albuquerque at 516 Central Avenue. You can find out more about that at 516arts.org. And you are kind of traveling with this book and putting it out into the world and putting the artwork from it out into the world and printing on some very beautiful paper. So this is a book that's going to have some, and a project that's going to have a longer life than just like a book signing.
I think often what I do is I've just had the luxury of spending 5 or 6 years with not attending to the social part of being an artist. And this book is important to me. I think for many things came together, including the writing. And so in order to give a book life, you sort of have to help it along. It's kind of like a child. So I'm not sure what I'm doing. Literally yesterday I was told the big crate of them arrived at the distributor in Chicago. So it's here. But I'm thinking more of, it's forcing me to, you're reading quotes from what I wrote. And when you write, that's all in your head. But it's forcing me into a conversation. And I think, you know, this is good for me. I'm like, I'll go home and go like, oh, did I really say that? Or did I really mean that? But you ask what's important, but it gives me an opportunity to do something that's important, which is really advocate for this vision of wildness in the wilderness that I think is beyond what we've been willing to really stand behind, which is really saying in and of itself, it's as important as we are to have wild places that are of a scale in which these animals can not just survive, but evolve. And, you know, that's what keeps the planet healthy. We're part of this. And so it's really this critical point in time of recognizing it. So this book will force me to get out there in the world, which I don't know. I really like it up there in the mountains. So
Well, it's good to have you down here in the world. Michael Berman, thank you for being with us.
And thank you for having me. Really a pleasure speaking to you.
And the Radio Cafe once again would like to thank its generous sponsors, the Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation, the Lenzic Performing Arts Center, the Santa Fe Institute, the Lannan Foundation, and Southwest Care. Thank you all so much for making this program possible. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Supporting social and emotional needs of students and teachers, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lannan Foundation for supporting the Radio Cafe. You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send us any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.